From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The jazz world and Sesame Street are in mourning. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the great singer Betty Carter and writer Jeff Moss. Moss was the creator of Cookie Monster and Oscar the Grouch and wrote many of Sesame Street's best-known songs like Rubber Ducky and I Love Trash. He died of cancer at the age of 56. We'll listen back to an interview at the piano during which he performed some of his songs. Betty Carter was one of the greatest contemporary jazz singers and vocal improvisers. She died this weekend of pancreatic cancer at the age of 69. We'll listen back to an interview with her and play a few of her many wonderful recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hurricane George slammed into the Gulf Coast this morning with torrential rains and sustained winds of more than 100 miles an hour. Forecasters say the storm could dump more than 2 feet of rain on some areas before it slowly drifts away from the region. 10 inches of rain have already fallen in southern Alabama. A wind gust of 172 miles an hour was recorded in Biloxi, Mississippi. The storm has flattened many power lines and trees and triggered flooding. NPR's Debbie Elliott is in Foley, Alabama.
We're just waiting on the rain and the winds to stop so that people can actually get out and see where the damage is. This storm churned up the biggest waves I have ever seen in the Gulf of Mexico. They had been pounding coastal areas all day long yesterday and all through the night. When officials go in today to check the damage, they're going to find more than just piers gone and seawalls gone. There's going to be some structural damage.
NPR's Debbie Elliott. Flash flood and tornado warnings have been posted along the Gulf Coast from Alabama to Louisiana. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat have achieved a breakthrough on a plan for withdrawal of Israeli troops from parts of the West Bank. The two leaders are meeting today at the White House with President Clinton. Israeli diplomats say under the plan, Israel will withdraw from an additional 13% of the West Bank territory. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and the country's new prime minister, Yevgeny Primakov, have made some slight progress in their efforts to complete the formation of a cabinet. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the new government has been 2 weeks in the making.
Yeltsin and Primakov agreed to reappoint the country's privatization minister, but they fired two prominent reformers, former tax chief Boris Fyodorov and former deputy prime minister Viktor Khristienko. Primakov has had trouble finishing work on his cabinet list. His deputy prime minister in charge of finances, Alexander Shokin, walked out of the coalition government Friday after only 9 days on the job. Primakov says he will not rush to fill that post. Even without a complete cabinet lineup or an economic policy, the Russian prime minister is pushing ahead with his priority, paying back wages. He told Yeltsin today his government has paid the armed forces 2 months of overdue wages and will soon begin to give students their stipends. It's not clear how much the government is spending or where it is finding the funds. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Attorney General Janet Reno was released from a Washington hospital this morning after an overnight stay following her second fainting spell in a year. A spokesman for Georgetown University Medical Center said Reno's doctors have pronounced her 100% fit for duty. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 116 points at 8,145 in moderate trading of 279 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 22. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stock market investors appear to be in an upbeat mood to start the new week, apparently largely based on expectations that when the Federal Reserve Policy Board meets tomorrow, the central bank will announce an interest rate cut. NPR's Jack Spear joins us with the latest.
Anticipation that the Federal Reserve Board will move to chop the short-term rates it controls by at least a quarter of a percentage point tomorrow is largely what's driving Wall Street today. Whether that will actually happen, though, is still far from a foregone conclusion. While most analysts think the Fed will cut rates before the end of the year, the timing and the degree of such interest rate cuts are still in some dispute. There is also plenty of major corporate news to kick off Wall Street's week. McDonald's today announced a $3.5 billion stock buyback. The Oak Brook, Illinois-based fast food chain says it plans to open 2,000 restaurants a year over the next several years. And DuPont said it will get out of the oil business within the next 12 months, divesting itself of its Conoco division via a shareholder spinoff and an initial public stock offering. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Ford Motor Company's outgoing chairman, Alex Trotman, says the company is open to the possibility of joining forces with another automaker. But a Ford spokesman says, given the size of the company and the Ford family's voting bloc, an acquisition is more likely than a merger. Ford already owns one-third of Japanese automaker Mazda and a 16% stake of Korea's Kia Motors. Goldman Sachs is expected to announce today whether it will delay its initial public stock offering. Some analysts expect the 129-year-old private investment bank to delay the IPO until the global financial turmoil settles down a bit. Goldman's partners had voted in June to sell up to 15% of the firm in early November. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jeff Moss, the creator of Cookie Monster and Oscar the Grouch, died on Thursday at the age of 56. The cause was colon cancer. Moss was one of the original writers on Sesame Street and wrote many of the best-known songs on the show, including I Love Trash, The People in Your Neighborhood, and Rubber Ducky, which was a top 40 hit. He was to Miss Piggy what Cole Porter was to Ethel Merman. Moss won 14 Emmys for his work on Sesame Street. He received an Academy Award nomination for his songs in The Muppets Take Manhattan. Moss also wrote children's books. His characters and songs were loved by generations of children. Back in 1994, we thought it would be fun to hear the composer sing some of his own songs, so we invited Jeff Moss to join us at the piano in our studio. We remember him today with a rebroadcast of that show. Jeff Moss, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Tara.
Why don't we start with the song that's your chart buster? It actually made it to, I think, number 16 on the Billboard chart.
Something like that, back a few years ago. The highest on the charts ever, I think, for a song sung by a guy in a bathtub. A rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Vovodio, rubber ducky, joy of joys. When I squeeze you, you make noise. Rubber ducky, you're my very best friend, it's true. Oh, every day when I make my way to the tubby, I find a little fellow who's cute and yellow and chubby. Rub-a-dub-dubby, rubber ducky, you're so fine. And I'm lucky that you're mine. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of. Rubber ducky, I'd like a whole pond of. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you.
Great. I should have been squeezing it in the background, right?
In fact, it was I who was squeezing it in the background
on
those
record.
Many years ago on the record, yeah.
So how did you write the song?
Well, depending which story I tell, either it was very late at night and I was there alone in my tub with my rubber duck just overcome with the poetry of the song, or I had created a character of the rubber duck for Ernie, and it was just, he loved it. It was his passion, his obsession, and it just overflowed that way.
And Jeff Moss, you were one of the original writers on Sesame Street. When you signed on to do the show, was it understood you'd be writing songs, too, and that songs would be an important part of the program?
In fact, we thought that songs might be an important part of the program, but no. Joe Raposo was the original music director, and In fact, we found out we were going to use records, and we found out because it was public television, it was very hard to clear the rights to use them. So Joe came to me and said, well, look, you write words and music, I write words and music, why don't we just do it? We'll write to the curriculum, we'll do it faster. Joe was wonderfully ebullient. He said, we'll do it better, let's just go do it, and we did it.
Were you already writing songs? Did you have confidence you could do this?
Oh, sure.
What kind of songs had you been writing?
Well, from the time I was 9 or 10, I'd been writing songs to, entertain my friends. And then in college, I'd written the musical comedy stuff in college. And then my first job, which had been at another children's television show called Captain Kangaroo, I'd written a lot of songs for there.
Huh. So now you were also in on the creation of some of the characters,
mm-hmm.
like Cookie Monster.
Indeed.
And Oscar.
Indeed.
Tell us about creating Cookie Monster.
Well, Cookie Monster, Jim and his people had created the physical monsters before Sesame Street, but they had always been quite scary, and they never spoke. But they were just such wonderful puppets that I went into somebody's office one day and said, well, how about that furry blue one with the boggly eyes? Could he maybe talk? And they said, well, you know, the puppeteers don't talk very much, and they're scary. And so I said, well, what if he doesn't talk very much, and I try to make him funny? And they said, well, go ahead and do it. And I wrote a bit for him in which he had two words, and one of them was milk, and the other one was cookie. And we were in the studio, and Frank Oz performed them just so brilliantly, we all fell off the seats, and I went back and started writing more.
Oh, I think this is a song cue. Why don't you do a Cookie Monster song?
Yeah, this is what he has for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, but he sings about breakfast today. He says, me have a soft boiled cookie with a glass of cookie juice on the side, or for a change one morning me will have me cookie scrambled or fried. It isn't hard each morning to keep me satisfied. Just give me a soft boiled cookie, please, with a glass of cookie juice on the side.
That's great. So was the voice your idea or Frank Oz's idea?
Oh, no, That's a poor imitation of Frank Oz, whose idea it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, you co-created Oscar.
Co-created Oscar, yeah.
And how did he come about?
He came about because the educators had suggested that we have a character who showed kids that it wasn't necessary to be cheerful all the time. So a grouch was created, and it was decided that he lived in a trash can, and then we sat down and kind of created this wonderful vicious circle for him, where if you make him happy, he hates that, and that makes him unhappy, but being unhappy makes him happy, so he likes that, but that makes him unhappy, etc., etc., etc. Meanwhile, he has his obsession and his passion, which is Oscar sings,
oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Oh, I love trash.
I like the idea that you put that in waltz time.
Yes, indeed. It was a good juxtaposition of trying to write a pretty waltz for a yucky character.
Did educators ever object to the fact that he was an unsanitary puppet?
Do you know, they didn't. But we think that today, if we were creating today, they might have. You know, they might have worried that kids would crawl in garbage cans and all that. But they never did. So the writers feel that the kids can discriminate. The educators test it out. We don't.
When you were younger, you had ambitions of writing Broadway musicals?
Well, in fact, I probably did, yeah. I grew up, I guess, during the late 50s, and I can remember, my father was on the stage, my father was an actor, and I can remember...
Really? Would I know him?
Arnold Moss, his name was, and he was a Shakespearean actor, and my earliest memories are theater memories, and I can remember The King and I and that kind of stuff, but by the time I was old enough to try it, it kind of was going in a different direction than it had been going, and I found Sesame Street, and that's the direction everything went.
Broadway, I imagine, was going in the ersatz rock direction?
It was going in rock, and it was going in the area where the songs were less important, where the production was much more important, and Bob Fosse's and Tommy Toon's and those people who were brilliant, but they were the stars. They were the people who were using, you know, the Gershwin songs rather than the new writers' songs.
Now, you got to write a Broadway musical in the sense that you wrote the songs for The Muppets Take Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
which is about
Absolutely.
The Muppets going to Manhattan to do
a Broadway
show.
Yes, at the Biltmore Theater.
did you get a chance to write the kinds of songs for that were very close to what you would have written for the stage?
I don't think so. They were more the kinds of songs that I would have written if I had been doing the Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies
right.
of the 30s, which is another way that one might look at Kermit. And
and Piggy, and the show that they put on was a very glitzy Broadway show. But there was jazz in that score that I wrote, and there was rock, and there was waltzes again, and kind of ragtime.
You got an Academy Award nomination for the songs that you wrote for The Muppets Take Manhattan. Let me ask you to do one of the songs from there. It's a song you wrote for Miss Piggy about how she wants to be a movie star.
Yeah, she wanted to be everything and love her man at the same time. She's saying, I want to be a movie star, and I want to learn to drive a car. I want to be a veterinarian, too, and I'm going to always love you. And then she's saying, I'll be the cutest model you ever saw, and then I think I'll study criminal law. And I'm going to learn to scuba dive, too, and I'm going to always love you. Went on, and she wanted to climb the Matterhorn, but only after all her children were born. And she wanted to be a good mommy, too, but I want to always love you.
We're listening back to an interview with Jeff Moss, former head writer of Sesame Street. He died of cancer Thursday at the age of 56. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Jeff Moss, the former head writer of Sesame Street, who wrote many of the songs on the show. He died of cancer last Thursday. Our interview was recorded in 1994. Now, your first job after college, I think, was working on Captain Kangaroo as a production assistant. What was the job description?
There was no job description. The woman who hired me said, well, we have jobs for production assistant. You could choose either the CBS News or Captain Kangaroo. And I was being very young and flip, and I said, well, I've seen the news. And I hadn't seen Kangaroo, and that's where I ended up.
So you didn't grow up watching Captain Kangaroo?
No.
I'll confess, I never liked the show when I was growing up. I couldn't understand the attraction of what seemed to me to be an old man wearing overalls. and it was such a non-urban show to me that I just never related to it.
Well, it was non-urban, though it did have a moose who liked to drop ping-pong balls on people's heads, which was not urban, but neither was it particularly rural. But it's funny. It had a lot of funny stuff in it and a lot of educational stuff that I guess maybe we didn't realize, or the people who made the show didn't realize that it had. And I did that for 6 months and then came back as a writer for a couple of years. And it was a very nice place to begin.
So when you got the job on Sesame Street, were there things you felt you wanted to do different than the way you'd seen it done on Captain Kangaroo?
Everything about Sesame Street was new. The great thing was that we had a marvelous freedom that we didn't realize we had then. This is looking back on it. But Joan Cooney had raised a lot of money that couldn't be paid to anyone in salaries but could be spent on production. And we didn't have a network that we had to please. We didn't have stars that we had to please. We didn't have sponsors that we had to please. And we were committed to doing 130 hours of television. And there were four of us wrote 90% of the first year's show. And we could just have the most wonderful time as long as we were willing to work 37 hours a day. And we just did whatever we wanted to do that stuck to the curriculum. In the early years when I was head writer, I used to say to the writers, look, the two jobs you have is one to keep the 3 to 5 year old watching the TV, and the other one is to write a show that if you were spinning the dial, you would stop and watch yourself. And that's what we did creatively from the very, very beginning.
Was every song supposed to carry a lesson with it?
Yes, and almost every song did, and almost every piece of material on Sesame Street did and does.
Do you have a song that's your favorite lyric for teaching something in a really entertaining way?
Of the recent songs that I've done, we began doing racial relations as a goal a few years ago, just several years ago, and they wanted a song that would kind of be the corner post of that. It's a film of kids at the beach, kids playing at the beach in their bathing suits, and this is the way I chose to deal with it. Skin covered all over with beautiful skin. Skin covered all over from ankle to chin. Lovely skin on knees and noses and everywhere. Skin on tummies and toeses and under your hair, it's even there. Oh, skin, wonderful colors and beautiful tones. Skin, think of without it, you're nothing but bones. Skin is ever so lovely no matter the color you're in. Let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin, let's hear it for skin. Beautiful skin.
No, who sings that on the show?
It's the voice of Kevin Clash, who's one of the Muppets, but it's just a film of the kids playing at the beach. It's not a Muppet song.
That's a good song. Another of your little Tin Pan Alley numbers.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of kids' music did you grow up with? Did you listen to real music or kids' music when you were young?
You know, I don't think they had kids' music, whatever that is, when
I remember
was
having like little red records and little yellow records about Here Comes the Circus, Here Comes the
Tumblers. I remember classical music played a lot. I remember large 78s with green labels of you know, tango music. And I remember show music. I remember, you know, as I say, The King and I. But I remember Beethoven, Chopin. I don't remember kids' music.
What about rock and roll? When did you start hearing that?
I started hearing it when Bill Haley started doing Rock Around the Clock, which would have been the very, very late 50s when I was a teenager.
And the impact that had on you?
You know, at the time, I guess I tended to at least pretend to be above it. And then when it got to be the 70s, I realized that my ambition had always been to sing in a 50s rock and roll group. So I created that opportunity for myself on Sesame Street and created Little Jerry and the Monotones and wrote the first bass part a half note lower than the bass of the Muppets could sing. And then I just hung around and joined a 50s rock and roll group.
Well, you've been writing more books lately. And your new book is called Aronimus White. Tell us a little bit about the story, and then I want you to read the beginning of it.
Yeah, Hieronymus White, it's subtitled A Bird Who Believed That He Always Was Right. And it's about a bird who comes to believe that he always was right. It begins, goes back to way before he was born, when his parents are very young, and goes through to the point that his granddaughter has grown up. And it shows the good things about believing you're always right and the bad things, and it traces his life and comes to a point where something happens that causes him to no longer believe that he's always right. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right. He was always an expert, whatever the task. He would share his advice. There was no need to ask. When his children came down with a fever or chills, he'd order the doctor to choose different pills. When the postman delivered a package or letter, Hieronymus told him how he could do better. He approached every issue so confidently, he'd seem shocked at the thought that you might not agree. Yes, all through a life that was famous and long, Hieronymus thought that he couldn't be wrong, till one day late in life when his feathers were thinning. So now let's go back to the very beginning. This is the story of Hieronymus White, a bird who believed that he always was right.
I really like that. I'm sure I know this character.
Yes, I think we all do.
This character has given me too much advice over the years. So what inspired you to write this story?
I think I wanted to write, firstly, about a person who believed that he always was right. I have known a number of them in my life, and sometime don't have to go too much farther than the mirror to find one. And also I wanted to write about continuity and about passing things on from one generation to the next. And I began the story, and it kind of took off and became what it became.
Let me get you to do a short grumpy poem from a previous collection of poems called The Butterfly Jar.
This is called Hi, How Are You Today?
I'm feeling very horrible and low and mean and mad and dreadful and deplorable and rotten, sick and sad and nasty and unbearable and hateful, vile and blue. But thanks a lot for asking, and please tell me, how are you?
Very good. Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Me too.
Having you here on the show, I've really enjoyed it a lot. I'd love for you to end with a song, and you have actually a very sweet song about goodbyes. Maybe you can do that. Tell us first how you wrote it.
It's from The Muppets Take Manhattan, and it comes at a time when the Muppets are not being successful in their quest to become stars on Broadway, so they all have to split up and go in their various directions, and this is the song they sing. Saying goodbye, going away, seems like goodbye's such a hard thing to say. Touching a hand, wondering why, it's time for saying goodbye. Saying goodbye, why is it sad? Makes us remember the good times we've had. Much more to say, foolish to try. It's time for saying goodbye. Don't want to leave, still we both know. Sometimes it's better to go. Somehow I know we'll meet again. Don't know just where, and I'm not sure just when. You're in my heart, so until then. Want to smile, want to cry, saying goodbye.
Jeff Moss recorded in 1994. He was the former head writer of Sesame Street and wrote some of the show's best-known songs. He died last Thursday of colon cancer at the age of 56. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admission policies and their long-term consequences, in bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember singer, composer, and arranger Betty Carter. She died Saturday at the age of 69.
Pennies in a stream, falling leaves of sycamore, moonlight in side, snow light. telegraph cables they sing down the highway and travel each bit in the road. People who meet in this romantic setting are so hypnotized.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Betty Carter was so often described as one of the best living jazz singers, it truly hurts to say now she is gone. She died Saturday of pancreatic cancer at the age of 69. She not only had a beautiful, rich voice, she was a brilliant vocal improviser, often completely reimagining the songs she sang. Stanley Crouch described her as probably the most significant jazz singer since the emergence of Sarah Vaughan in the mid-40s. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot praised her for stretching time even farther than Billie Holiday. New York Times jazz critic Peter Watrous described her concerts as some of the most moving experiences in jazz. We're going to remember Betty Carter with an interview we recorded in 1990. First, let's hear some of her recent work. This is Close Your Eyes from her CD, I'm Yours, You're Mine.
Close your eyes, rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes, and I will close mine. Close your eyes. Let's pretend that we're both counting sheep. Close your eyes. Oh, this is divine. Music play. Something dreamy for dancing while we're here romancing. It's love's holiday. And love will be our guide. Close your eyes. When you open them, dear, I'll be near by your side. So won't you close your eyes?
When I spoke with Betty Carter in 1990, she had just released a CD called Dropping Things. I asked her about one of the songs on it. This is the Rodgers and Hammerstein song, What's the Use of Wondering? And
right.
It's from Carousel, isn't it?
Right.
Tell me why you chose the song. This is another example. This happens to me all the time, that there's a song that I really never cared much for, and suddenly I hear, well, in this case, I hear you sing it, and I say, hey, this song is really fine. It's beautiful the way you sing it.
Why didn't you care for it? Because of the lyrics, right?
I think it might be because of the movie of Carousel. I don't...
Well, the lyrics, you know, the lyrics are pretty much, you know, like most females wouldn't want to sing lyrics like this because it really caters to the man completely, you know. But the melody is so great, and I just think that people are missing out on this beautiful tune if it's not sung by more people, you know? And I changed the key in the bridge, you know, which I had to do in order to make it sound good to me, you know? So I think that's probably the reason why you like it.
Let's hear it. This is What's the Use of Wondering, and it's from Betty Carter's new album, Dropping Things.
What's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? Oh, if you like the way he wears his hat, what's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? Your fella and you love him, that's all there is to that.
Do you actively look for songs, or do they just happen to you? I don't mean songs you've written, but songs that you add to your repertoire.
No, I really look for songs that are a little different because you can't find them. You know, people just don't sing songs like Deep Night and things like that, you know. So I really go out and look for songs that haven't been overexposed by other singers. And I try to stay away from songs that have been sung a singer has become well-known with. I try to lay off of that particular song.
It's amazing how a good singer like you can take even a song with sentiment that might seem corny on the page and make it really come to life.
Well, if it's a corny lyric, then it's the music I like. And I put them together that way.
Having your own label, did that make you... having your own label made you independent, gave you the freedom to record what you wanted to record without a record company intervening and saying, no, add this, sing that. It also made you into a businesswoman. What else did it do, having being that independent?
Well, what it taught me was that I had to do what I had to do. It wasn't that I had any problems with record companies. It was the way the environment was running at the time. Record companies were not interested in really dealing with jazz artists. I wasn't the only person that was without a jazz label. There were a lot of jazz people that had the bigger names than mine and didn't have a major jazz label, a major label. I just thought I had to do what I had to do. I was told by a lady friend of mine in Jersey to do it myself, and she said, do it yourself, and I decided, well, okay, I'll do it myself and see what happens. And it was a slow process because I tried not to sell records on the job. I really wanted people to go to the record shops and ask for the record. I didn't really want to come off of a job and have a stack of records outside and selling them that way. So I avoided that.
Why did you want to avoid that? A lot of jazz musicians have a display of the records at the back of the room that they're playing.
I know that. I don't know why I didn't like that as much as a lot of other people do, but it was just something that I just couldn't do. And so I just wanted the people that wanted my records to go to the record shop and inquire about a record from Betty Carter, and then maybe the record shop would try to find out where he can get a Betty Carter record and put him in the shop. I really wanted my records in the shop, so the only way to do that was to create a demand. So that's what I tried to do.
Now, you sat in with Lionel Hampton one night, I think this was after you graduated high school, and based on that, he hired you. You sang with his band a couple of years. There were several singers in the band at that time. Was there a kind of number that you specialized in?
Yeah, I improvised all the time. It wasn't any particular number. I just improvised all the time. Anytime he wanted to put me in a song to improvise, he would let me do it.
You've said that you would have, at the time, preferred to be in, say, Dizzy Gillespie's band.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, it seemed like Hampton was the right place to be. Why?
Because it was better organized, and I got paid every week. And it was well run, and I had the role model of his wife that I didn't realize at that time was a real role model, because she was the person who was in control of the orchestra.
This is Gladys Hampton,
right?
Were there ever things that you were expected to do that you didn't want to do when you were performing with the Hampton Band?
That I was expected to do? No, there were some things I wanted to do that I wasn't allowed to do or wasn't able to do. And that was to really sing some songs, you know. But Ham thought I could improvise better. So that's what he had me do.
Did you ever feel earlier in your career that there were a lot of musicians who didn't take singers seriously and who didn't think that they were the equals of musicians? Of instrumentalists.
Well, you must remember that the jazz world is dominated by men, and as we know, men tend to think that they know more than most women, period. So let's not even put it in just the music business at all, you know. But since they did dominate the field of music, and they are the innovators, we must give them that kind of respect. Now, it's up to us as females, and we're getting there now, to take on this challenge and have them realize that we have talent also. A lot of us were really afraid to get out there and deal with men on the same level, but now we're doing that.
Let's talk a little more about your style of singing.
Oh.
you got started, you know, in the Hampton Band doing a lot of improvisation and stuff.
Right.
Now, when you sing a song, you often improvise on the melody.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean scat. I mean just.
Oh no.
Just
The melody has changed a little bit. Like you may have thought that I changed what the use of wondering is. You know, I know what you mean.
How did you start developing that?
Yeah, as you get older, your voice does change. And if you don't want to change keys, you better do something. You know? If you don't want to drop your key, then you'd better know what to do to compensate in keeping it in the same key. For instance, a lot of the songs I sing today are in the same key I sang them in 25 years ago. So I can't. My voice isn't as thin and as light as it was 25 years ago. It's heavier. It's thicker. So I have to challenge myself now. What can I do to compensate for all these things? So in order to, and then by doing that, you only educate yourself and you learn more about you, what you can, your capabilities, what you can do. And you find that you can do a whole lot of things. The breathing becomes different. Holding notes become different. Going from high to low becomes different. So you have to adjust to this. There's one song that I have been wanting to do for years, and the only way I'm going to ever do this song is to change key. And I refuse to do it because I don't want to change keys. I'm just stubborn enough to not want to change keys.
Well, what's wrong with changing keys? Why are you so attached to one key? Do you see it as a failure? It's because it's brighter.
I think that what it's done for me is make me fight for my sound. It makes me fight for my throat, to be a better singer, to be a stronger singer. If I adjust, I'm making it easy for myself. So if I change keys, I'm making it easier for myself. So if I don't change keys, I've got to reach for something. So this keeps me reaching for something.
Let's pause here and listen to one of Betty Carter's early recordings from 1955. This is Can't We Be Friends?
I thought I'd found a man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? I thought for once I couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Never again. Through with love, through with men. They play their game without shame, and who's to blame? I thought I'd find a man I could trust. What a bust. This is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Betty Carter after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1990 interview with jazz singer Betty Carter. She died of pancreatic cancer on Saturday. A couple of years ago, an album was reissued that was a real collector's item in the jazz world. I mean, I'm thinking of the album of duets you recorded with Ray Charles.
Right.
To give our listeners a sense of how much in demand this was, I mean, the most beat up, unlistenable copy of it would sell for like $60 or $80.
That was terrible.
So you know, now it's available on CD and on record again. What was your reaction when it was brought out? And I'm wondering if you were consulted and.
I wasn't consulted because, you know, I recorded this album in 1960 with Ray Charles when I didn't have a name at all. And at that time, he did have a name. He had a name because he had recorded Georgia. And you remember how big Georgia was, you know? And I was doing some theater tours with him when he asked me to do the album with him. Now, when the record was reissued, say, a couple years ago, I wasn't the person to be consulted because, if you know, I didn't have any control over the record in the first place. I was just singing the part that he gave me to sing, you know. So, but he did let me know that the record was coming out. He called me up and told me that the record was coming out, on what label it was coming out on, and that he would see to it that I got some copies. And that was the gist of it.
I want to play something from the album of duets that you recorded with Ray Charles. And this is Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Ooh.
Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Well, it's a song that I never thought I would ever sing, that's for sure.
What? You know,
I just never thought I would ever sing it. And I never thought it would really be a favorite song for people these days. I mean, I really didn't believe it would really catch on this and stay alive this long where people, wherever I work, without Ray Charles, people ask me to sing Baby, It's Cold Outside. It's really weird, you know?
You think it's a very slight song?
No. It's not that. It's just that I never dreamed that it would be this effective.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just never thought it would be this effective, that people would ask me to do it by myself.
Okay, well, here it is. Baby, It's Cold Outside, performed by my guest Betty Carter with Ray Charles, recorded in 1960.
Outside.
I've got to go away.
Betty, it's cold out there.
This evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful.
Worry.
What's your hurry?
And Father will be pacing.
Listen to that fireplace roar.
So really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Well, maybe just a half.
Why don't
drink
you
more?
Put some records on while I pour?
And the neighbors might think
Betty, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this dream?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlight now.
To break the spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks
red. I ought to say no, no.
Mind
no, sir.
If I move in closer.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
Can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Ah, oh, but it's cold outside.
Betty Carter is my guest. You've raised two sons, and I think you used to perform when you were pregnant, right?
Oh, sure.
Was that done much then? For what? Singers?
I think so. I mean, I think Dinah Washington did that. A lot of singers didn't have any kids. I think Nancy Wilson did. Ella Fitzgerald, I don't think, did, or Sarah. You know, so I think the people that had kids did. I mean, we just, if we wanted to keep working, we did.
Were you able to get suitable maternity clothes for performance?
If I wasn't able to get them, I made them.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Was it hard raising two children while often being on the road? As you mentioned, a lot of singers didn't have children to raise. So
yeah, well,
you were in a tough spot.
You know, I really, you know, at that time I didn't think about it. You know, when I hear talk shows now, when they talk about raising kids and working, I started to think about how did I get through that, because I didn't really think about it being very difficult because I was going to do what I had to do. My first son was born on March the 14th in 1961, and I was on the road doing with Ray Charles for a month of one-nighters in April that following the same year. So I didn't even think about it. I mean, I didn't think about it as something difficult to do, like they're thinking about it these days.
I think a lot of singers probably had bands put together for them or trios put together for them. You've always hired your own musicians.
Oh, yeah.
How do you find the musicians who you hire? You often find young musicians who then go on to, you know, careers of their own, but you often find people who no one knows yet. No one knows yet.
Well, I at one time used musicians that people knew, but as I grew older, I felt that I needed something young under me. I needed some energy under me. I really felt like Art Blakey felt about youth inspiring you, giving you the enthusiasm that you need to stay on top of things, to stay young and stay fresh. So I started hiring young musicians about 15 to maybe 16, 17 years ago. And when the word gets out that you will hire young musicians, you know, they will come from everywhere for the job.
When you're working with young players, you probably have to teach them a lot.
Have to rehearse a lot and teach a lot. You have to be very patient. But that's also good for me. It's also good for me because if I didn't do that, suppose I had someone who knew everything anyway, I wouldn't rehearse as much, and I wouldn't come up with fresh ideas as much, you know. It's like me writing 30 years, 17 years ago, and also dropping things I wrote 20 years ago. And I tried it out with each group that I had through the years, and I never felt, no one gave me the feeling that they really wanted to tackle it until this year. And when I played Dropping Things for the young musicians that I have today, they were enthusiastic about the tune. And because of their enthusiasm, I hung in there and got something out of the tune.
We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Betty Carter after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1990 interview with jazz singer Betty Carter. She died of pancreatic cancer on Saturday. Is it ever hard to find young jazz musicians who know and appreciate songs?
No. No. The thing is that they don't even know these songs to have any feeling about them one way or the other, because when you're dealing with musicians that are 20 years old, the standards are brand new to them. They haven't been overexposed to these standards like people my age have been, or another piano player who's my age. He's heard this song 1,000 different ways, and so he knows it up and down. This young piano player will come at this tune in a different way from the back door because he doesn't know it.
You strike me as someone who's never allowed themselves to be a victim. And I bring that up because I think, I think a lot of great artists have led tragic lives, have been the victim of either bad management or drugs or just something that either killed them or made them very weak. And you just strike me as someone who's always been kind of strong and independent and has taken charge of things.
Well, you can say that I've pretty much taken charge of my career because I relied on people, on the audience. When they appreciate what I do and appreciated in the past what I did, I've decided that that was the way I was going to go. I wasn't ever going to let them down. So whenever I got on the stage, I decided to do a job. I wanted them to be pleased. I wanted them to be satisfied and to have a good time coming to catch me work, whether I had a record out there or not. That was the only way I was going to survive in this business without having a hit record, especially after the mid-60s when hit record was the only thing, the only way you weren't going to get a record label. You had to become a good performer so that the club owners would rehire you when you got a job because you wanted people to come to catch you work. And if you fill the club up, it make no difference whether you had a hit record or not. The club owner was going to hire you. So that was my job, was to become a good performer and to deal with the music also. And I did. I took a lot of risk on the job. And that, to me, was what people like to see me do.
How is your life different now than it was 10 years ago?
Well, I'm a little bit more known, and the records are more available now. I'm getting more money, you might say that, but I'm still a performer. I haven't changed that. I haven't changed my stage presence yet. And I'm not going to ever change that because that's me. What you see is what you get when you come to see me.
Our interview with Betty Carter was recorded in 1990. She died Saturday of pancreatic cancer at the age of 69. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Chris Fraley. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Let's close with Betty Carter's 1964 recording of Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most.
Spring this year has got me feeling like a horse that never left the pole. Staring up at the ceiling, spring can really hang you up the most. Morning's kiss wakes trees. that spring